Tibetan Buddhism is also fully developed in several other ways. Tibetan Buddhism is highly intellectual. I've mentioned a little early on that the Tibetans in some parts of Tibet until recently didn't even have the wheel. Well, this doesn't mean that they're primitive. It doesn't mean that they're uncivilized. It doesn't mean that they're uncultured. It certainly doesn't mean that they're stupid. Tibetan Buddhism is perhaps the most highly intellectual form of Buddhism that we know today. It's the only part of the Buddhist world, incidentally, Tibet is the only part of the Buddhist world where Indian Buddhist logic is a living tradition. Ancient Indian Buddhism was a very highly intellectual tradition, and amongst other things, they developed logic. Well, in the West, we've had logic. Logic was started, as you all know, by Aristotle, and it was continued and developed during the Middle Ages, and then again in modern times. So there's a great logical tradition in the West. Similarly, there was a great logical tradition in India, and Buddhism did more to develop logic than any other religion, than any other single influence. And this tradition of Indian logic passed to Tibet. It didn't go to China. For some reason or other, the Chinese didn't take to logic. Didn't go to Japan. But it went to Tibet, and the Tibetan Buddhists are traditionally very, very fond indeed of Buddhist logic. So this goes to show that intelligence and understanding in the real sense are not necessarily correlated with any particular degree of technological or material civilization. Again, the tradition of the exegesis of the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom tradition, has been continued and elaborated even in Tibet. The perfection of wisdom sutras are among the grandest and sublimest in the whole field of Buddhist canonical literature. They were elaborated, they were produced in India, and they went to all other Buddhist countries of the Far East, China and Japan especially. But it's only in Tibet that they really continued the study of them. It's only in Tibet that you get, or at least you did get, the tradition of the exegesis, the teaching and the explanation of the Prajnaparamita. I remember in this connection there's another story about Dr. Konza. Dr. Konza spent several years in the United States of America. He's just come back to this country because he let fall, I gather, a rather unfortunate remark about the Vietnam War. So he was out in a matter of weeks. And here he is again, back in England. But Dr. Konza once related, and I heard him relate this myself at Oxford, he related that he met in New Jersey a Sakyapa Lama. A Sakyapa Lama. A Lama of the Sakya sect. And as I said a little while ago, the Sakyapas are very learned. Now, Dr. Konza is a man who has devoted nearly 30 years of his life to studying and translating the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And that is no mean task. And he's done it single-handed. So to translate the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras and the Abhisamma Alankara and a few odd works like that, one naturally requires tremendous understanding, tremendous knowledge, tremendous scholarly equipment. But there were just a few points, a few knotty points, that even Dr. Konza couldn't clear up by himself. So he told us one day that he went to this Sakya Lama, who was then residing in New Jersey, in the United States, and he just put to him, he knew a bit of Tibetan, he put to him some of these knotty points, some of these difficulties. And he said the Sakya Lama started explaining and expounding. I think Dr. Konza said, when he'd been going on for a couple of hours, he said, I felt I knew nothing about the perfection of wisdom. He said, I became aware of the existence of stores, vast stores, of knowledge of these things, the existence of which I hadn't even suspected. And this is from Dr. Konza. And Dr. Konza is not the sort of person, I can assure you, who hands out unnecessary compliments. If anything, it's the other way around. But this is what he said. So this goes to show that in Tibet there was this tremendous intellectual tradition, this tradition of Buddhist logic, of the exegesis of the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, teachings, and so on. Yet, at the same time, Tibetan Buddhism is very highly devotional. Very highly devotional indeed. All Tibetan Buddhists, including these very learned geishas, including these people who are up to their necks, as it were, in logic and the perfection of wisdom, they've all got very strong devotional feelings for the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and so on. They are not one-sidedly intellectual. Yes, they have developed the intellect. They developed it perhaps as far as it's humanly possible to develop it, but not one-sidedly. The emotional side, the devotional side, has been developed too. And this shows itself, one can see, in all sorts of small ways. One notices it in the way in which Tibetans, including these same intellectual Tibetans, handle, for instance, images. If you hand a Tibetan an image, say a Buddha image or a Bodhisattva image, to a Tibetan, whether learned or unlearned, he takes it, he accepts it very, very reverently, and treats it very, very carefully. As like as not, he'll put it just to his head or his forehead as a gesture of respect. And it's the same for the sacred writings. To a Tibetan, it's unthinkable just to fling a book aside. He thinks that's awful, that's disgraceful, especially the sacred scriptures. And there are very few books which are not sacred scriptures. So this is the sort of profoundly reverential and devotional approach that they do have. And in fact, one may say that in Tibetan Buddhism, whether it's a question of the ordinary Buddhist, or whether it's the monk, or the learned monk, or the abbot, the intellectual and the emotional aspects of the religious life are not really divided at all. This is another thing that we can learn from Tibetan Buddhism, that intense intellectuality combined with profound and intense devotion and emotion. For them, there's no question of what T.S. Eliot has called in a different context, dissociation of sensibility. Now, just as one finds in Tibetan Buddhism this beautiful balance between the intellectual and the emotional or devotional, one finds a similar balance between study and meditation. One may say without any hesitation at all that some of the most learned men in the Buddhist world are or were to be found among the geishas and lamas of Tibet. They very often do have absolutely encyclopedic knowledge. I remember once a little experience of my own. I went to see a great lama called Khyentse Rinpoche, from whom I afterwards received certain initiations. So he was very interested in various aspects of Indian literature. So in the course of conversation, I was expecting to hear something about meditation or something like this. So this lama said to me, without any sort of preamble, he said, through an interpreter, "Do you know anything about dancing?" So I said, "Well, no, not really." So I wondered what he was getting at. So he paused and he said, "Have you read any books about dancing?" I said, "No." He said, "Have you seen any dancing?" I said, "Well, sometimes Indian classical dancer, I've seen that." He said, "Oh, you haven't happened to have read any books about Indian classical dance?" So I said, "No, I've heard that there are such books, like the Natya Shastra and so on, but I haven't actually read them." So I said, "Ah." He said, "I've read 14 books on Indian classical dance. There are a few knotty points I want to clear up." So he had come from a remote corner of eastern Tibet, and here he was studying texts on Indian dance in Tibetan translation, they're all in the Tanjur, and wanting to clear up a few knotty points. And I subsequently came to understand that these texts were the basis of the famous Lama dances. So it wasn't unconnected, and he was very, very interested in this. And I believe subsequently, with the help of Indian scholars, he did follow it up, and he did get a few more treatises on that particular subject procured. But this is just an illustration of their many-sidedness, their encyclopedic interests. And he was exceptional, he was remarkable, even among Tibetan lamas. So amongst Tibetan lamas, amongst the Tibetan monks, you find, as I say, some of the most learned men in the whole Buddhist world. But at the same time, you find amongst these same monks, these same lamas, some of the greatest yogins, some of the greatest meditators in the whole Buddhist world. And what is still more remarkable, what is still more wonderful, occasionally you find the two combined in one. So think of Milarepa. Milarepa is Tibet's greatest yogi. He's also Tibet's greatest poet. Just think what that would mean, say, in the context of English literature. Suppose the man who wrote Hamlet, the man who wrote King Lear, had also written The Cloud of Unknowing, or had also Well, perhaps I ought not to go any further than that. Suppose you've got that sort of combination in one person. But this is what we have in the case of Milarepa, greatest poet, greatest yogin. And you can see a number of other instances of this sort of thing in Tibetan Buddhism. People who are great scholars with wonderful intellectual understanding, but at the same time, great yogins, profound meditators, understanding not only the theory, but the practice of the spiritual life. And this person I've just mentioned, this great Lama I've just mentioned, Khyentse Rinpoche, he was one of this type. He wasn't just a dry-as-dust bookworm by any means. He was always reading, he was always studying, but he was also always meditating. He was a great yogin as well, and he was famous as a combination of these two. And I'm told that among the Gelugpas in Dalhousie, there's another Lama who is of the same type. I haven't met him, but I've heard about him. A great scholar, a very great scholar, but at the same time, a great yogin. Just to institute one or two more comparisons, it's rather as though you've got someone like Bertrand Russell, who was also on the quieter sort of St. John of the Cross. Now, to our Western way of thinking, this sort of combination is fantastic, it's unbelievable, it's extraordinary. It violates all the precedents, it breaks all the canons. But this is what we do get in Tibet. Even in the Christian tradition in the Middle Ages, you don't get this. St. Thomas Aquinas was a great scholar, a great theologian, but it's only towards the end of his life that he turned to mysticism, and then he gave up theology and died. St. Francis, yes, a great... St. Francis, yes, a great spiritual soul, certainly. But what did he know about theology? Probably didn't know anything, didn't need to know. But suppose you had combined in one person the genius of St. Thomas Aquinas, his intellectual insight, and the simplicity and spiritual experience of St. Francis. What then? Well, this is the sort of thing that one does find, even today, in Tibetan Buddhism. And this is the sort of thing that we can learn from Tibetan Buddhism. This sort of balanced approach.